Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea, and let's begin. Today's episode is hosted by Marion McConaughey.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Herbcast. Today I'm going to be talking to herbalist Marie Riley about how herbalism can support a healthy cycle. Marie has over 20 years' experience as a medical herbalist. After training at the College of Phytotherapy, she went on to do a master's at the Scottish School of Herbal Medicine, where she researched the treatment of female functional infertility. She's also the author of the book Herbal Medicine and Reproductive Health, and teaches on the practitioner training courses at the Plant Medicine School in Cork, Excelsior in Belfast, and Botonica in the UK. She currently regularly supervises training clinics for students from various courses in the UK and Ireland. So Marie, really lovely to have you on today. Welcome.
Thank you.
It looks from your background that reproductive health has been a bit of a focus for you throughout your career. What first inspired you to focus on that area of herbal medicine?
Well, I suppose just being in practice and practicing generally, as I still do, treating all manner of conditions, it just happened that lots of people came looking for help with those particular conditions. And I think the reason for that is that it is one area where there isn't a great deal to offer from the point of view of orthodox medicine that is both effective and safe. Mm-hmm. So there are obviously lots of treatments available through orthodox medicine, but lots of them, for example, would preclude pregnancy. So people who are trying to conceive, those medications or treatments wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for them. So, for example, if somebody has PCOS, they're often put on the contraceptive pill. But of course, that's not helpful if you're trying to become pregnant. Mm. Endometriosis often is treated by inducing a temporary state of menopause. So again, you know, not ideal for people trying to become pregnant. And I suppose as well as that, there are side effects, marked side effects to lots of those kinds of treatments. So I suppose people just are looking for an alternative to that. And then when they come looking for help with reproductive health conditions, it really works. Herbal medicine is really, really effective. Yeah. And I think people are often very surprised at how effective it can be. So when you're offering something that is safe and very low on side effects and really works, then word spreads. So it just ended up being something I was treating a lot. And then in particular, people coming for help with fertility, either because they would rather avoid assisted reproduction interventions like IVF, because again, they're expensive, you know, there's lots of side effects, it's a difficult journey. So, you know, some people would like to try herbal medicine and natural approaches first. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's that people are opting for IVF or other kinds of assisted reproduction and they want it to be as successful as possible. So they use herbal medicine and other natural approaches kind of as a backup to maximize their chances. And when I was seeing so many people and getting good results, you know, I suppose that impels you or to look into it more and learn more. And then I focused on that when I was doing the master's.
Mm, yeah, word spreads when you're having results.
That's right.
Yeah. So what sort of conditions do you commonly see in your practice on a day-to-day basis then?
Well, I suppose, you know, while I have kind of ended up specialising in that area, I do see everything from, you know, acute chest infections to arthritis to, you know, autoimmune conditions, all kinds of things. And then in the kind of reproductive health area, again, I guess it's everything, you know, from PMS, perimenopause, endometriosis, just such a wide range of different things. But it does keep it very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I imagine things like fertility and helping people with that journey is really satisfying. Sort of which conditions do you find most satisfying to treat, or where the herbal approach is of most benefit?
Well, I would think that I suppose the reproductive conditions generally, I think you see a massive benefit, say, maybe compared to some other things. But, I mean, even I would find, say, skin conditions, treating skin conditions quite rewarding because for some reason I don't really understand. It seems to be something that Orthodox medicine finds it quite hard to even diagnose correctly. I think probably because of use of steroids and things like that, that just tends to suppress everything. And I think the one thing that's very rewarding is in any condition, if people have kind of run the gamut of lots of different practitioners and therapies and, you know, and really haven't got anywhere, you know, they maybe haven't got a definitive diagnosis, you know, haven't been helped, and they're kind of at the end of their tether, and they come for herbal medicine, and you're able to kind of give them more clarity about what's going on. Maybe they have had a diagnosis or maybe they haven't, but even if they have, the fact that it's kind of explained to them. And I guess it's a lot about the amount of time that we spend with people as herbalists, because, you know, it's really that, you know, taking this full medical history where we look at the whole person gives you clues that you're not going to get if you're only speaking to somebody for 10 or 15 minutes. So you're getting a really deep understanding. And I think then that allows for, you know, a more likelihood that you're going to get an accurate diagnosis, and helps you to really tailor your approach to that individual. So I think that kind of applies to all health conditions. But with reproductive health, again, sometimes people have a diagnosis, like they might have been diagnosed with endometriosis or PCOS or whatever. But oftentimes they aren't given a diagnosis. You know, if they are trying to conceive and, you know, they may have had all the tests and nothing shows up. So they have no answers, which is very frustrating. So again, with herbal medicine or other kind of natural approaches where you do this really in-depth holistic consultation, then you're often able to find the contributing factors that have been missed, you know. And I would find that with fertility particularly, it's almost like, I mean, obviously it's natural to reproduce, it's what every species is kind of geared towards. But at the same time, it's also very natural that any little thing will knock it off balance. So I suppose any human body will be looking at whether or not it is, you know, the conditions are amenable for reproduction. So if there's something slightly wrong, the nutrition slightly wrong might tell the body, oh, you know, there isn't going to be enough nutrition here to support a pregnancy. Or if conditions outside are very stressful, you know, that body is going to feel maybe it's not safe to conceive, and so on and so forth. So it's very easy just to knock the reproductive path off. And things like that generally don't tend to be picked up by blood tests very easily, or by scans or whatever. But equally, it's sometimes easy just to nudge somebody back into fertility. So, you know, and then in those cases, something like IVF might be really using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. I mean, obviously, for some people, IVF, if they want to conceive, that's going to be necessary. You know, if there are conditions that completely preclude intercourse, or, you know, if the sperm motility is so low that it's just not going to happen, then IVF is brilliant for those people. But for lots of people, you know, the problem maybe is only small and it doesn't require that level of intervention. So, yeah.
I mean, I think quite often when you're having a consultation with a client and speaking to them in depth about their health and what's going on, they'll often have their own aha moment as they're describing what's happening and be like, oh, right, this is starting to ring bells. This might be why I'm having problems, or I hadn't thought about it like that. Sometimes that can be really useful. Do you find that sometimes there's a fertility problem without any other indications? You know, for example, something, the cycle appears to be fully functioning, but yet still the fertility is sort of not there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, lots of people would have very few symptoms or signs of there being anything wrong at all. You know, they can have a completely normal cycle and very few symptoms, but just not be conceiving. And that, I suppose, sometimes that can be one of the most common things that you see, because I think where people have other underlying conditions, they're possibly more likely to, you know, just go down the orthodox route. Whereas a lot of people would feel like, well, if I'm not getting any diagnosis, then, you know, how do they know how to treat me? So they're often the people that would kind of seek alternatives before going for orthodox treatment. But most of the time you find something. So, you know, it could be everything's normal. And of course, the other thing is what people consider normal. How do we even know what's normal and healthy? So, I mean, the number of people that walk around with like really bad digestive issues. And I mean, this is why things like ovarian cancer and bowel cancer often get diagnosed so late, is because a lot of people just accept it as normal that the digestive system creates wind and gas and bloating and pain and all of those kind of things. And people just put up with that. And likewise, people who menstruate have, you know, they'll often believe that pain is normal. And for some people it is. But how do you know? How do you know how heavy your flow is supposed to be? You know, you if you're leaking all over the place, then you probably have an indication that, you know, maybe it is heavy. But and, you know, and if you only have minor spotting that barely needs any sanitary protection at all, you probably have an idea that it's light. But in between that, how do you know what's normal? We don't see other women menstruating, so we don't know. And then, you know, clotting and all of these kind of things, it's very difficult to know what's normal. So you know, you'll often find kind of things like that that will maybe indicate some kind of minor hormonal imbalance that could be just enough to be preventing fertility, or maybe somebody's circulation is quite poor. And they're not, you know, because it's their hands and feet, perhaps they're not thinking that, well, if your hands and feet aren't receiving good circulation, maybe your ovaries and uterus aren't either. So little things like that. And then, of course, you know, the other hormonal changes that lots of people feel are normal, like premenstrual breast tenderness or mood changes, you know, they can all point to certain, you know, hormone imbalances that might be causing the infertility.
Yeah. And other than a really good sort of case history, do you use blood tests and other types of diagnostic tools in your clinic?
Yes, I rarely, you know, send off for blood tests myself anymore. Although we might have to start doing it more again. And the reason is that most people will have had some investigations done before they ever come to see me. And that will usually involve the standard kind of tests that GPs do to assess fertility. Sometimes people will have been to fertility clinics as well and had a wider range of tests done. But even if they haven't, for people to get their blood test done through a GP is normally the most cost-effective option, because, you know, GPs will usually test the full blood count. So, you know, even without testing things like B12 and folate and ferritin, the full blood count will nearly tell you if things are, you know, somebody's deficient in those things when you're looking at like the mean cell volume and things like that. You know, they all test the lipids and so cholesterol and triglycerides and things like that. But if and I know that often they're thinking about cardiovascular health when they test those things. But if you remember that cholesterol is the kind of building block of lots of hormones, you know, then that will often maybe indicate whether there's something off with the thyroid or those kind of things. Often, you know, GPs will test thyroid, and thyroid function is very important for fertility and reproductive health generally. And then hopefully they will also test things like FSH, LH, estrogen, progesterone, those kind of basic things. And for the most part, you get loads of information from just those very basic blood tests. Prolactin as well, obviously, is important. So, you know, if you kind of know how to read them properly, then it will tell you lots. And then I know that some people then will go for very detailed, or offer, you know, some practitioners will offer very detailed investigations, like, for example, the Dutch test. And that's really interesting. You know, that provides really, really interesting information. And particularly if you're learning about hormones and hormone balance and things like that. But from a kind of a practical point of view for patients, I think it's quite limited, because, you know, if you're a practitioner and you have a Dutch test done for somebody and it tells you, you know, they're slightly low in allopregnanolone and, you know, slightly high in pregnenolone, and you just like, what are you going to do about that? You know, do we actually have herbs that are so detailed that we can influence the individual progesterone metabolites? And if we can't, then what are the benefits of us having tests that are that precise? And yes, I mean, it will tell you more about, you know, whether somebody's estrogen is too high or too low. But really, if you're a skilled practitioner, the clinical signs will tell you that. And I suppose what I would be worried about is natural practitioners, nutritionists and herbalists and so on, following down the road of the orthodox profession, whereby we become so reliant on laboratory tests and scans that we stop looking at the patient, because in my mind, that's what's happened in a lot of orthodox scenarios, is that now they only look at the blood tests and the scans and the person and what they're telling their practitioner about how they're feeling, what they intuit is wrong with them. Now, they're not always spot on, but they'll give you a really good signpost most of the time.
Mm.
So I think, you know, we shouldn't lose that. You know, looking at somebody's skin and hair and breast size and weight distribution, you know, the heaviness or otherwise of their periods, all of these kind of things will tell you much more closely what's going on with somebody's hormones. And again, as I say, the Dutch test and those other kinds of detailed tests are very interesting. And if people want them, I'll absolutely read them and help people with them. But they're out of reach financially for lots of people.
Yeah, yeah. It's already expensive to go and see a herbalist, you know, when seeing a conventional doctor is generally free. So that's already a big jump, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Hi there, it's Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know that there are plenty more Herbal Insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. You can check out some of our special sections, for example, our foraging area, showing you how to correctly identify and harvest wild species. And then in our recipes section, you can learn ways of turning them into some delicious and effective health solutions. And for the researchers amongst you, we have regular reviews of research articles, dissecting the detail and bringing you the relevant insights. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
It's interesting you're talking about impacting progesterone metabolites and things like that. I was mulling over and with one of my other conversations that I've been having in this series about herbs that we use for reproductive health that don't seem to have direct impact on hormonal function. And some of these are things like yarrow and alchamilla and Angelica sinensis. But in your book, I was reading that some of those are believed to have progesterone effects. So is some of this, some of our understanding, is it that it's incomplete and we haven't figured it out yet? Or what do you think of that?
Well, yes, I'm sure it is incomplete because there's always more that we can find out. But I suppose, you know, having an effect on, say, progesterone function, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's direct. Mm. You know, for example, you know, in order to produce progesterone, the person has to ovulate. So, you know, lots of herbalists talk about increasing progesterone. But, you know, there's very, very little progesterone, say, produced via the adrenal glands. You know, single figures, absolutely. You're never, ever going to get above that. So the bulk of progesterone, you know, during the reproductive years is produced by the corpus luteum, which is only present after ovulation. So, you know, if you start at the very beginning, the first thing is you have to get that person's body into a state where they can ovulate.
Mm.
So that might not be a progesterogenic herb. That might just mean making sure they're eating enough.
Yeah.
You know, it might just mean that their stress levels are reduced to the point that the body will allow them to ovulate. So that might be nervine herbs, or it might be counseling, or it might be meditation, you know. So mm-hmm. So that could be the kind of starting point. And then also, you know, if you're going to increase the circulation to the ovaries, then that's going to bring all the nutrients and the oxygen and all of the things that are going to allow those cells to operate properly. So, like, it's known that yarrow does influence the circulation, absolutely. Mm. So maybe it's that way that it's acting. You have to avoid having stagnation around the ovaries, because then the progesterone that they produce, it has to be carried around the body. So you know, there's so many ways in which it could you know, that you can impact those things. So it's not necessarily always a direct thing. I suppose all we can really know for sure is like the end result. So I suppose we're never really going to know exactly the steps.
Yeah. Making sure the body's as healthy as possible to encourage as healthy a cycle as possible so that everything works well. In your book, you combine kind of both explanations of science and some sort of break it down really sort of quite technical things into really understandable language. But you also combine that with energetics, so both from TCM and Ayurvedic traditions. It's really satisfying when you look at that and the energetics and the science align. Have you ever come across any contradictory situations where the energetics is telling you one thing, but sort of your current understanding of the research and science is telling you something else?
Not really. I don't think so. I don't recall having that kind of quandary happening. I know, you know, when I trained initially, there was very little really about energetics. There was a little bit kind of humoral type medicine, but, you know, certainly not kind of Ayurvedic or TCM approaches. And I suppose I kind of got interested in that later on, well, even quite soon, I suppose, after qualifying, because, you know, when you're training, you do your clinical practice hours with lots of different herbalists. And so, you know, these things crop up that way. And I would have had some acupuncture and things like that myself. And, you know, that would have started off an understanding. And I guess I probably felt a little bit limited in practicing just using herbs without any major thought for the energetic side of things. Mm. And then, I mean, there are so many herbs. I mean, obviously, at one time, we would have had to just use the herbs that grew in our locality. So that would have naturally limited us. And I know some people still do that, which is brilliant and kind of sustainable. But we also do have the option to use herbs from all around the world. So we have massive choice now in what we can use. So I suppose kind of using the energetics helps to choose the herbs as well. Mm. And of course, when I first got into these things, then you kind of experiment with using them in that very traditional way. So, you know, compiling a Chinese type prescription is a very different process to, you know, if you're following more kind of Western medical model. So I kind of did a little bit of that, or, you know, Ayurveda, where you're just treating the doshas and things and not really looking so much at the actual orthodox or Western side of things. And I found that wasn't great either, to be honest. I didn't get, you know, the results that I wanted. Mm. But what I find now is combining the two levels of understanding is just phenomenal in what you can achieve. Really phenomenal. It's just like you're adding an extra layer,
an extra filter. I mean, it makes sense if we're using herbs from these different traditional forms of medicine to have some understanding about where they've come from or where their knowledge has come from.
And I wouldn't, you know, if I and it's just really kind of intuitive the way it presents itself. I mean, I suppose where it's really, really helpful is in that kind of scenario you described, where somebody comes and, you know, they're just not conceiving, but there's nothing really. There's no symptoms. There's no real abnormalities. Blood tests are normal, all of that kind of thing. And what do you even have to go on in those kind of situations? So then a really good place to start is just to treat them energetically.
Yeah. And see where you go from there. So you mentioned earlier a little bit about thyroid and how important thyroid function is. in fertility. And quite often, if there's something going on with the thyroid, it's linked to autoimmunity. Do you see a sort of a common link between autoimmune processes and fertility issues?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, it is huge. And it is known that a person who has an auto, you know, thyroid autoantibodies, even if they don't have a thyroid abnormality in terms of the thyroid hormones themselves, because obviously their antibodies can be there before there's any, and sometimes there isn't. Sometimes the thyroid levels stay normal. And what you'll sometimes see is, for example, a person who has the Hashimoto's type antibodies, you know, parts of the thyroid will be destroyed, but they'll start growing a goiter and the new thyroid tissue will then produce thyroid hormones. And so they'll manage to kind of compensate and keep their levels normal, but the antibodies are there still. And that can very much cause other issues like sometimes joint pain or fatigue. And definitely it's kind of known, you know, from the research that those antibodies can affect fertility. And also, you know, people with other kinds of autoimmune conditions, particularly things like lupus, that will very much affect fertility as well.
Yeah. So I find with people with autoimmune thyroid conditions that avoiding gluten is really helpful because of the structure of the molecule being quite similar. Are there any other kind of nutrition protocols or recommendations that you have for supporting fertility and or a healthy cycle?
Well, definitely, I think gluten is huge, a huge issue in, you know, subfertility and infertility. So partly from that point of view, the thyroid health, you know, if there's any indication that there's any kind of thyroid immune autoimmunity, then I do advise people to avoid gluten. But also in any kind of autoimmunity, it does seem to make a difference. So, and not even people with fertility issues, but like in other kinds, people with MS, people with rheumatoid arthritis, you know, they do tend to see a difference when they stop gluten, and when they eat it again, they do tend to find that it's associated with flare-ups, which are obviously easier to see with things like joint pathologies as compared to autoimmune thyroid, you know. So, and but then the other thing with gluten is that if there's a kind of a subclinical type gluten intolerance, that has been in itself associated with infertility as well. So it's not fully known, I don't think, unless there's more research since that I haven't come across, whether that has to do with the immune system exclusively, you know, and is there some kind of autoimmunity that, you know, like an autoimmunity towards the gluten that, you know, affects the ovaries or whatever? Or is it that a person who has gluten intolerance, you know, there's a certain amount of malabsorption that happens, and maybe that is then meaning that the person doesn't have all of the nutrients that they need for a very healthy reproductive system. So usually if people are struggling to conceive at all, I just say, look, it's just easier to just try and avoid the gluten. And not have that as something that stands in your way. And I do find as well, generally with gluten, you know, some people, of course, will test positive for anti-gluten antibodies. But there are, certainly in Ireland anyway, there are huge numbers of people who will have the blood test. The anti-gluten antibodies aren't positive, but when they stop eating gluten, they notice very marked improvements in their health. And, you know, if they reintroduce it, they notice the symptoms. So there does seem to be people who don't test positive. Now, I don't know. I mean, it is said that, you know, not everybody with celiac disease will test positive for the antibodies, and a biopsy really is the only definitive thing. Mm. But I mean, I have had some patients that have had biopsies and it hasn't really shown up either. But it's very, very obvious from their own alterations to their diet what's going on. Mm. So normally, you know, if somebody comes and says, oh, I've been tested for that and I don't have it, then I think, well, just
give it a go.
Avoid the gluten anyway.
Yeah, it's worth it if you're really serious about making sure your health is up to scratch. I'd like to chat quickly about endometriosis. It's a really tricky condition. I think it's likely that with the sort of case histories that herbalists take and the amount of time we spend with patients, we're more likely to spot it or more likely to diagnose it than conventional doctors. What sort of treatment or protocols do you use, and do you think there's something autoimmune going on there as well?
Yeah, it's difficult to know. I mean it is notoriously difficult to diagnose, you know, say even ultrasound scans and MRIs and things like that, they can pick it up, but usually, well, MRIs anyway, but usually only by the time it's quite advanced. Mm. So a person, you know, will have had it for quite a number of years before there's anything really obvious showing up on scans, unless, you know, they have chocolate cysts, which, you know, what might be more easy to detect in a scan, but, you know, not everybody has those. So I guess the only definitive diagnosis is with laparoscopy, which mm. obviously is quite an invasive kind of a procedure. But with herbal medicine, there are things that would suggest that that might be something that's going on. But even if it isn't definitively endometriosis, when you're treating the pattern that somebody has that suggests that they might have endometriosis, that it usually improves anyway. Mm. So I suppose the end goal really is for the person to be well, and that's all that really matters. Mm. So, and it does really help. I mean, I've even had patients who've come, you know, and maybe they have had, or they're waiting for laparoscopic surgery, and they're just trying to get some relief in the meantime. And they're very surprised at how effective the treatment is. Mm. And often they delay or just don't even have the surgery that they do so well. So normally it's obviously a estrogen dependent condition. So, you know, the first thing really is to balance that out, to look at, you know, where is there, you know, is there excess estrogen coming into the body through the diet, you know, through mm-hmm. non-organic animal produce maybe, xenoestrogens from plastics or pesticides or things like that, and try and get rid of all of that from the diet. And then looking at the liver function and helping the liver to remove any excess estrogen from the body. Mm. And looking at the bowel health to make sure that the estrogen is actually removed from the body completely and not kind of reabsorbed. And that can involve, you know, looking at the microbiota and making sure that the bacteria in the bowel aren't cleaving the conjugated estrogen and allowing it to be reabsorbed into the body.
Mm. What sort of approach do you take for improving microbiome?
Well, I suppose a lot of it is just with diet, because, you know, a diet that's very high in kind of processed foods and refined carbs and things like that will encourage the development of the types of bacteria that, you know, will be troublesome. So even just, you know, switching to healthier foods will begin to have an effect on the microbiome. So basically trying to cut out as much as possible the foods that feed the bad bacteria, and introducing, you know, foods that are easier to digest. And some people can help to repopulate the gut with things like fermented foods. Some people, if their microbiome is very off, can't even tolerate the fermented foods, in which case you have to go for probiotics and prebiotics and things like that.
I've seen quite a lot of interesting research on culinary herbs and spices and improving microbiome and gut function as well. Things like ginger and peppermint and things like that.
Yeah, and those kinds of herbs, I suppose, you know, traditionally people would have used a lot more of those types of herbs to control what bacteria are developing in the gut. And people maybe don't so much anymore. And also, you know, traditionally we probably would have eaten a lot more vegetables, whereas now it's a lot easier to eat a lot more carbs. And as well as that, then you know, the we would have eaten maybe more greens, more bitter type flavors, whereas of course the way foods have been hybridized and changed in recent years, you know, people lose that affinity for bitter tastes and, you know, prefer things. So then we're probably missing out on a lot of those kind of herbs that will help the liver to process toxins and estrogens and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. We need to be grazing at the hedgerows, bitter greens after every meal. Well, we've come to the end of our time. It's been really interesting talking to you, Marie. Thank you so much for coming along today.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website and, of course, on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care, and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.